Selling is a skill. It's a science. It's not an art. No one's born in the world and they're a born salesman. It just doesn't happen that way. Having trained loads and loads of salespeople and run sales organizations with teams of salespeople working for me, some of my best salespeople were introverts. It's a skill. It's a learnable skill.
Hello and welcome to the Start, Build and Grow podcast. I'm your host, Rob Lawrence, and in this short podcast series, you're going to learn how to run and grow your business more effectively, gaining insights and inspiration from our panel of hand-selected coaches, mentors, and experts in the enterprise community. In the next few weeks, you'll learn things to consider at the start of your business journey, how to run your business effectively, and tips on everything from finance to marketing to managing people and strategy to help you develop and grow a sustainable and profitable business. Before we begin and get stuck in, don't forget to follow and subscribe to this podcast through your favorite podcast player app. My guest today is Matt Sykes, who is an expert in sales and selling and has his own sales training business and podcast called Sales Cadence. He's the author of two books, including Sales Glue and Converted, and has delivered sales training and coaching to hundreds of salespeople across the UK and Western Europe. Today, in the next 50 minutes or so, he's going to give us some of his best tips and ideas when it comes to successful selling, no matter what size of business or market you are operating in. With more than 20 years in sales and being known as the person who helps you to avoid doing the easy things that make selling difficult, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you today, Matt Sykes. So Matt, a very warm welcome to the podcast.
Excited about what we're going to discuss.
Yeah, it's great to have you on here. Tell me a little bit about you, Matt, because I appreciate our listener may not know who you are. You've written a couple of books about selling and sales. Tell me a little bit more about those and your backstory.
Yeah, so classic salesperson. Most salespeople tend to fall into the career, Rob, if I'm honest with you. It's one of those careers that isn't really a mandatory accreditation. And every organization, obviously, we'll probably go on to talk about this, I guess, every organization needs sales. And so there's always a large amount of opportunity for anybody that wants to go and have a career in sales. I guess the challenge with that, of course, because it's not regulated, anyone can get into it. And that was pretty much the case for me. I guess there are two answers to the question in terms of the backstory. Number one, my very first sales job where I was paid, I was born in the late 60s, so mid 80s, I'm leaving high school. There wasn't really a desire to go into further education around about those, back in those days when Margaret Thatcher was running the country. It was roll your sleeves up, son, get out there and go and get a job. And so that's exactly what I did. And I went to work in a high street shoe shop. I had a lot of fun in the time that I worked in there. I learned some lessons, funny enough. You mentioned the book. I've written about my experiences working in the shoe shop in the book. So that was my first taste. And I got quite intrigued as well, Rob, because I was rubbish at it. As you can imagine, a 16-year-old, got no training, no understanding of what selling is, gets thrust into this showroom full of people. And it was a bit of a car crash. But I learned some things from a wonderful store manager. The second answer to the question in terms of the backstory is I found myself a number of years later in my first corporate selling job. So I had a background in print. I worked in an organization as a printer, and then a vacancy came up for a sales guy based up in the northwest of the UK. So I applied for the job. They gave me the job. Back to that first point, I said that anyone pretty much can get a job, can fall into one. I had no background experience, but I could talk a good game. I was quite well presented and I was keen to move on. So I was an account manager, a bit of a sales exec role, really. I had a bunch of clients that were all buying packaging. Most of them, Rob, tended to be in the DIY world. So I was basically selling to paint companies. And that's really how the journey kind of started, really. And I've been in the industry for 25 years. Loads and loads of lows, loads and loads of highs, and pulled all of those stories together and wrote a couple of books. Sales Glue I wrote initially 2015. I subsequently put a second edition out this year. That's more of a book which links the world of psychology and how you think, the behavioral traits that salespeople can have and some of the challenges that come our way if we aren't able to understand a bit more about the human psychology side of selling. Converted, which I wrote during the pandemic in 2020, is pretty much sort of the basics of here's a lead, here's what you need to do to turn that into cash. And that's really me, really.
I appreciate the summary. I'm sure there's a lot we can get into in terms of your story and what you've learned. But just before we get into some of the fundamentals of sales and selling, which I'd love to do with you today, you mentioned, you know, lots of highs, lots of lows, and you also mentioned there you found it really challenging and you weren't very good at it to begin with. So how come you've stuck with it?
That's such a great question. Why have I stuck with it? I have a huge passion for the whole industry. I'm a people person at the end of the day, Rob, and you know, where I sort of can add real value, if you like, for want of a better expression, is the ability to join up the dots. And so what I mean by that is, you know, selling is all about helping people, helping the right people solve the right problems that they've got, make the right decisions, but to do that on your terms. That's normally how I define selling. Because I'm a people person per se, I'm really intrigued. I'm quite curious about people when they come to me for, let's just say for argument's sake, they want some help and advice on sales training. Rather than saying, yes, we do that, come over here and let's sign you up, it's, well, why do you want it? And so curiosity is a big part of what I'm all about. I want to really make sure that if someone's coming to me for some advice, well, let's understand what's really going on behind the scenes there. So why have I stuck with it? I just really love that side of the business of unpacking and trying to understand and diagnose somebody's problem. Then pulling together the right solution. And sometimes that solution might not be with me. You know, quite a lot of the time, people will come to you with what they think to be the right answer or the right solution to their problem.
Yeah.
And when we get into the conversation and we have a really good sort of sit down diagnosis session, turns out that that problem might not necessarily be the main one. So I get quite intrigued and fascinated by that. But the bottom line to the question and the answer really, Rob, is I just like hanging around with people, really. But there's also another side to it as well, which is there's a lot of satisfaction that comes with helping people make the right decisions. And of course, there's an impact on me as well personally in terms of, you know, the fulfillment I get out of the job. So long-winded answer, but that's the reason why I've stuck in it.
That's fascinating, Matt. Actually, I heard a number of things there. So it's very much about people. It's very much about solving problems. And there are some problems you enjoy solving. And perhaps that's some of the key to how you've stuck it out through the highs and the lows. But I think that's a really interesting perspective on selling. So let's talk a little bit about that and what selling means to you. Because I think we're kind of getting into it here. We're talking about solving problems. It involves people and it involves a certain sort of psychology as well. So understanding the sales process, which we'll get into a little bit today as well, and understanding what that is. So in your worldview, Matt, what is selling to you?
I think we have to answer the question of what isn't selling first. I think that's quite an important one just for the listener, really, because what selling isn't is going up to a complete stranger or looking them in the eye and saying, why don't you buy my stuff, friend? Because, you know, that's just insanity. It's like you wouldn't go into a pub, go up to a stranger, tap them on the shoulder and say, hi, my name's Matt. Let me tell you all about how great I am. And sadly, whilst that's a general way of describing things, I do, and maybe the listener also might witness some of that behavior going on, that there is unfortunately still a little bit of a stereotype around the world of sales. I think a lot of that is a legacy from the sort of the 80s and 90s where selling was all about push and hard sell. Fortunately, those days have gone, but we've still got this legacy where people are still mildly uncomfortable when they come into contact with a salesperson. So selling isn't about tapping someone on the shoulder and saying, buy my stuff. What selling is, a bit like I alluded to in that first answer, really, Rob, selling is about, let's forget the word sell, let's use the word help. I think that's a really good starting point. You've got to find the right people, first of all. And what I mean by the right people, Rob, is there are some people that we're meant to serve and others not so much. To be really good at helping people, you've got to find the right person that fits with the work that you do, with the solution that you've got or the improvement that you can make for them, because there'll be some people out there that just aren't going to be the right fit for you. So you've got to find the right people. You've got to challenge both yourself and them to have a really good, deep, robust and insightful conversation, essentially questions. They've got to be willing to allow you to ask those questions. So to some extent, you're asking for their permission to be quite vulnerable, because if we're really going to understand the root cause of somebody's problem that they've brought to us, then we might have to uncover some things that they weren't aware of or go to some places that they perhaps weren't hoping to go or expecting to go in. But if we can get that level of trust at the start and we can go into that direction where we can fully understand somebody, then we can help them, because don't forget, they're the most important person in this, not me as the sales guy. They're the one with the problem. I'm here to help them. If we can get to that level of detail, then I'm pretty convinced we can help them make the right decision. And that's really what selling is all about. It's the right people allowing themselves to answer the right questions so that we can get to the right solution so they can make the right decision.
This is great, Matt. And you've already inspired a number of other questions that I want to ask you around all of that. Before I go there, how is selling, in your opinion, different to marketing? Because I could understand for somebody new to this, they might get a little bit confused. And I know that sometimes I hear people use the terms interchangeably, which doesn't feel right to me. So what are your thoughts on that, Matt?
It's a great question. I have a podcast myself. I interviewed somebody just last week who was a very experienced marketeer and posed the same question, which is the most important. And her answer, which is absolutely on point, is, well, they are both equally as important. We can't have one without the other. So what does marketing do? Well, the example I often use is they're the ones to get the bees around the honeypot. So how can they create engagement, attraction, you know, lay those sort of breadcrumbs of, sometimes it's referred to as products for prospects, those things that you click or download or listen. I mean, this podcast is a perfect example where somebody can go on in their own time, in their own space, without any threat or fear of being in front of a salesperson, and go and consume some information and start to build that level of trust. And that's what marketing's really designed to do, get bees around the honeypot. Sales, their job is then to decide which of those bees is the queen bee, and really isolating that one person in that pool of people that are knocking on the door or having a look, and then take that person along that journey of discovery, and then ultimately into a position where, you know, let's cut to the chase. The whole point of selling really is to make a sale. So you wouldn't necessarily send the SAS into battle, you'd send an army, right? In fact, you might not need to go to battle if the army goes first, because the enemy will say, well, that's quite a big army. I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing because I don't want that lot coming anywhere near me. But equally, you wouldn't send the army into a very finite op where you've just got to take one person out. You'd send the SAS in there. And so I look at the army as being marketing, and I see the SAS a little bit like the sales. I don't know if that's explained it well enough, but fundamentally, you need them both.
It brings those ideas to life, and I love those analogies, Matt. So thanks for putting it in those terms, because that's really helped me to sort of picture the difference and where these things fit together. So coming back to what you were saying earlier then, I felt a sort of sense of relief, actually. It takes some of the pressure off when we're trying to help people solve a problem. And also when this is almost a sort of a people-centered approach in terms of sales, and you sort of alluded earlier to how the reputation and the nature of sales has changed over the decades in terms of the push sales. And nowadays, this is about helping people to solve problems, which of course is a great way to develop trust in that. But it's a very people-focused skill, isn't it, Matt? So I think with that in mind, particularly for small businesses, and I recognize that a lot of small businesses are just the founder in the early days, and sometimes for many years on. And so I guess what makes a good salesperson, in your opinion, Matt, in terms of some of those people skills, and what other attributes can be developed, I suppose, to help somebody become a better salesperson?
First of all, I love the word you use there, which is skill. We should just circle back to that. Selling is a skill, okay? It's a science. It's not an art. No one's born in the world and they're a born salesman. It just doesn't happen that way. I think there are definitely people who are more aligned with that kind of characteristic of being outgoing and positive. But I would also say that having trained loads and loads of salespeople and run sales organizations with teams of salespeople working for me, some of my best salespeople were introverts. So I can't subscribe to the fact that selling is an art. It's not. It's a science. It's a skill. It's a learnable skill. Back to the point from earlier, the challenge that we've got in the industry is because there's no accreditation, there's no exam or years MBAs worth of work to go through, anyone can go into the industry. And then unfortunately, you're then at the mercy of either, is this individual going to go and train themselves, or are they going to go and work for an organization that accepts that they need to train this person? And what normally happens is, Rob, someone hands you a laptop, a phone and a set of car keys and say, congratulations, off you go. You're in sales. And that's where it all starts to fall down a little bit. So first and foremost, it's a skill. Let's think of Malcolm Gladwell. I think the book was Outliers, 10,000 hours. So you have to kind of expect the fact that if you want to get good at anything, whether that's selling or whatever it might be, you've got to devote some time. You know, there's a reason why a pilot can fly a plane with 300 passengers on it. It's because they've done hours and hours and hours of work to get there. So first and foremost, you've got to do the hard yards and you've got to learn how to sell if you're going to avoid making those mistakes that sometimes people make that make selling difficult. In terms of characteristics, however, though, I think there are some fundamental human skills that we already have as people, which really, really lend themselves to the world of sales. And I often talk, when I get the opportunity to talk in front of rooms, I always talk about sales skills being life skills. And so we've talked a little bit about curiosity. That would be the most important thing. If you're curious by nature, I think you're already going to give yourself a bit of an advantage if you ever decided to go into the world of selling. So curiosity, I think, is the number one. Second one is empathy. Empathy is such an important skill for selling, because if I can get really curious about you, Rob, and understand what's going on behind the scenes in his world, why has he come to me for some advice or asked me some questions, or what's the problem that he's got? If I can unpack that box with a bit of curiosity, if I'm then willing to put myself in your shoes and say, right, if I was Rob, what would I want to get out of this situation? I think empathy is so crucial, because if I can understand you, I can better serve you better. And if I can better serve you better, because you trust me more, you're going to be more open to helping me serve you. And so you've got this kind of almost like this two-way street going on, which works beautifully. And then the third element is, and this is probably the hardest of the three, I would say, is you've got to be able to inspire people. Now, you haven't got to stand on a box and wave your arms around in the air when I talk about inspiring people. Inspiring comes from being quite passionate about whatever it is that you do, right? They've come to you for a reason. They've come to you because they've worked out through the marketing strategy, the fact that they've listened to some podcasts, they've, you know, sampled some of your content in downloads or whatever it might be. They've decided that you're the person that fits the brief as being the kind of the expert that can help them. And because of that fact, and because you are an expert in what you do, because that's why you're in business, it should be quite easy for you to inspire people. We're not talking about hitting them with some kind of spammy sales pitch here. We're basically saying, look, I've understood your problem. I know I can help you. Let me show how I can do that. And if you can just be quite inspirational in the way that you deliver that message, I think those are the three component pieces, really. And most of us have most, or at least two of those three, I think, in our locker anyway.
That's really fascinating, Matt. And I was particularly taken by the point you said there that some of your best salespeople were introverts. Could you tell me a little bit more about that, Matt?
When I hire people, I mean, obviously I work for myself, but I did spend about 3 years, just under 3 years recently working as a head of sales for an outsourced service provider. Mature startup, rapidly scaling and growing. And it wasn't too long after I was in the door that we were starting to build out the sales team and hire salespeople. And one of the things I've always done throughout my career in senior sales roles when I've hired team is I'm a big fan of profiling people. So not necessarily Myers-Briggs or DISC, things like that, but there is one particular product on the marketplace which I always used. It was a series of qualification questions, a set of diagnosis tool, but within that were a number of red flags. And if there was one area that would red flag and pop up, it would be, can this person be coached? Now, what was really interesting about the organization that I used for the training, you get your report back, you've got this, you're looking at effectively a traffic light response, Rob. You can see a sea of green, one or two oranges, and there's just one red flag there. So in my world, I'm thinking, I'm hiring this person. And then, of course, when you go back and you go through the feedback with the provider of the tool, I sort of remember looking at him down the lens, and he looked quite seriously at me, almost shaking his head. And I said, come on, tell me the bad news. He said, well, it might look pretty good being green, predominantly green and a bit of orange, but that one red flag, I've never known anybody to hire someone with that red flag showing and have a successful outcome either for you or the candidate within 6 months. And that red flag is this. Can this person be coached? And back to the point of an introvert, I genuinely believe that most introverts can be coached. Maybe it's just my sort of sense of how I evaluate people. I think an extrovert who thinks that they know the answers or is, you know, quite shouty or nods a lot, but in the back of their mind, they're saying no, I think they're the hardest people to work with. And the irony here, of course, Rob, is that most people would say, oh, he's got a firm handshake. He can talk a good game, must be a salesperson. The reality is, I've found anyway, introverts tend to be far more considered. They don't want to come over as a threat. By their very nature, they're quite soft-spoken. They don't want to make themselves look foolish. And by doing that, they'll make sure that the other person, i.e. the buyer, is doing most of the talking. And one of the things that I train to most of my clients, funny enough, just before we came on this call, I was evaluating an audio sample from one of my clients. And when you look at the little box that tells you who was doing the most talking, he was doing 69% of the talking. It kind of got the metrics around the wrong way, really. We need to be talking just 30% maximum so that they're telling us what, you know, what their challenges are. So I just think that from an introvert's perspective, it's a lot easier for you to grow into being more extroverted than trying to reverse engineer an extrovert to becoming slightly quieter.
Gotcha. So with that in mind, Matt, what can we do to build our confidence to sell?
Yeah, that's another super question. I'm going to go back to that pilot example as well. You and I can both agree that when we're sitting on a plane and they shut the doors and they're going into pushback and the pilot comes over and tells us in a very calm and considered and downward inflection tone, he's going to tell us exactly what we're about to do. We're pushing back now. Make yourselves comfortable. We're heading out over to the east runway. Once we get up to 35,000 feet, I'll come back and let you know what's going on. But until then, just sit back and enjoy yourselves. And as soon as the seatbelt sign comes off, you can move around the cabin. Now, as soon as we hear that, our minds are put at rest. And so we feel quite confident. And the reason we feel confident is because we're in the hands of an expert. And so how do we build our confidence to sell? Well, we become the expert. Okay, so back to that Malcolm Gladwell thing. Number one thing I would suggest to anybody that wants to grow their confidence, yes, we can start talking about all psychological tips and tricks, but there's nothing more empowering from a confidence perspective of knowing that you can do a job, regardless of what the job is. Because I know from my own experience of working in the outsourced service business, probably did 1,100 calls with prospects on 30-minute Teams calls over that period of time. So you can imagine after doing 1,100 calls, effectively using the same number of steps that you would go through, that you get to a point where it becomes, you become unconsciously competent. You can do it with your eyes shut. And when you've got that base framework embedded, it then allows you to be far more, shall we say, fluid with the way that you deliver it. And so you can be far more confident in that delivery, and therefore you can be far more easier on the ear. You can be less of a threat because you're not reading off a script, because you've just got this thing down pat. So first thing I would say to anybody who wants to improve their confidence is, well, go and do the hard yards and learn how to do it. There's nothing more empowering for you as an individual to know that you can do something very, very well. I think the second thing I would say is, to build confidence, we have to accept that sales is a risky business, Rob. We are going to get quite a lot of no's. And so if you're happy to accept that you're going to probably get a few more no's than yeses, because that's just the way it works, because not everybody either wants to buy right now or will buy right now. If we're willing to accept that, I mean, so I heard a fascinating fact recently, which is, of an inbound created lead. So if it's a lead created by a buyer or a prospect, let's just say it comes through your website. Of the leads that come through your website are created by a buyer or a prospect, 60% of those will go nowhere. I'm not saying they'll end up being a yes or a no, go nowhere, being a no. They will just disappear and dissolve. People will think, I just must get in touch with Rob. I've been meaning to start a podcast up. They do that on a Friday night when they're watching Netflix, glass of wine in the hand. They wake up on Saturday morning, they've completely forgotten they've put a contact form for your website. That's okay, that's just life. But when you recognize the fact that there are some risks, and if we use that 60% of inbound leads probably are going to go nowhere, when you've got that level of information, you think, well, okay, in that case, everybody that I speak to now, I just need to understand that there's an element of risk here for me. And if I'm happy to accept there's an element of risk, if we add into that as well, we might get a no. If we're happy to accept as well that sometimes there's going to be things called objections, people might not be comfortable with your price, or they might need to speak to other people, and they might want to wait a little bit longer than perhaps you want them to do. All of those things are going to happen. If we know in advance they are going to happen, it takes the pressure off us. So mitigate the risks by doing some research and know what the downsides could be so that you're prepared in advance. Some you can't influence, some you might be able to. And then the third thing I would say to build your confidence is, don't be an imposter. I believe there are three levels that every sales, or three states that a salesperson goes in. State number one is imposter, okay? For some strange reason, Rob, and I don't know why this happens, salespeople tend to put this big mask on when you meet them for the first time, and they become this kind of weird morphed version of sort of Alan Partridge and, I don't know, somebody else. It's almost like, why are you behaving this way? All jokes aside, most salespeople believe that in the first exchanges, the easiest way that they can help themselves, and this is where they get it wrong, because you're not helping yourself, you're helping another person. The easiest way I can help myself is I'll get Rob to like me. Because if I can get Rob to like me, he's probably going to buy from me. And so we put this imposter mask on, we pretend to be somebody that we're not, and actually the opposite happens. Because I don't know about you, Rob, but whenever I come into contact with somebody who says, hi, how are you today? And I immediately know this is a salesperson. My sales shield goes up and I start to shut down the conversation. So the third piece of advice is, don't be that imposter. Be yourself. You can't get it wrong, right? You just can't get it wrong if you're yourself. So be yourself. Go and do the hard yards. Go and do some research and understand things that could go wrong, and you'll be surprised at how much stuff will start going right.
Brilliant tips there, Matt. Thanks for those. That leads me very nicely into a question I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, what are some of the common mistakes that you see, more specifically, perhaps small business owners making when they're trying to sell?
I think big mistake number one, and I'm guilty of this, Rob. So I started my company almost 10 years ago. I left the corporate sales role. I was European sales director in that packaging organization, decided it was time to go and try my luck on my own. Didn't really have the knowledge to be able to start my own business. So I did the next best thing and I bought a franchise. My mistake was, I naturally assumed that by buying a franchise, day one, leads are going to come in, orders are going to arrive, I'm going to be earning money. Now, in some franchises, that could well be the case, ergo McDonald's, but I didn't have £1.5 million set aside to buy a McDonald's franchise. You know, I'm spending a few thousand pounds on a training franchise model. And so the first mistake really I think we can make is, we just need to accept the fact that in the first, certainly the first 12 months, you are not running a business, you are creating a sales machine, because nothing happens till someone sells something. Your business isn't a business without cash. You won't get cash if you can't translate what you do into some kind of conversation which helps people decide to lend you or give you their money. So one of the first mistakes is not accepting the fact that you are really going to become a salesperson in those first few months. Another mistake I'm also guilty of, Rob, is key for sole traders, this one is, we will be happy to spend hours in our home office creating elaborate marketing strategies, posting on LinkedIn, sometimes investing money with outsourced marketing companies to generate leads and opportunity. And that's great, because that's a really important part of building a business. But you'd be amazed the number of people that don't invest that amount of time and money in knowing how to close the lead. And that's really a big mistake I see, is you spend all that time and effort and money, and you got these bees around your honeypot, and one of them's turned up as the queen bee and wants to buy what you sell, and then you've got this closable opportunity which ends in a no. That is an absolute sin. And a lot of the work that I do, with certainly with sole traders and small businesses, is, look, how much time are you spending getting good at having sales conversations? You know, you can be yourself, but there are one or two things I think that you can do that you should invest your time in to learn how to do that, because you'll make not only your life easier, but you'll probably turn a far more of those leads into cash. And so, long-winded answer, I think we can waste a lot of time. Small businesses can waste a lot of time spending on marketing. If you get that bit right, and I'm sure you will, make sure you know how to close a sale. And then the third thing really is probably not so much about sales. This is more about how we spend our time, Rob. It was a really fascinating piece of work that an organization called Sherlaws did. They're a consultancy firm. It's on the internet, so I can tell you this. It's their licensed product, but I can talk to you about it. It's called Red, Blue, Black. And Red, Blue, Black was such a game changer that one of the top four consultancy firms, I can't remember if it's KPMG or one of the others, I wanted to buy Red, Blue, Black from Sherlaws for £10 million. And Red, Blue, Black is the simplest thing you will ever hear. And it's this. On your to-do list, you color code three things, three colors. The red stuff, that's all the admin work that you've got to do. So, you know, doing your month-end accounts or your expenses or, you know, whatever it might be that's, let's call it admin. These are the tasks that you have to do because your business relies on them being done, but you can't make any money from doing them. They're a cost. Then you've got the blue stuff. The blue stuff are the high value, high return activities. So in my world of selling, having conversations with prospects, delivering sales training, coaching one-to-one, going to networking events, all those kind of things I can tangibly link an invoice to those things. Yeah, they're going to make me some money this year. And then the black stuff is all of the things that are going to make me money next year. So everything to do with marketing and podcasts and that kind of thing. You'll be amazed what the color ratio looks like in a startup firm. Predominantly, it's either red or it's black, and there's very little blue. And so if you can start to color code how you spend your time in a small business in the early first few months, and you use the ratio of red 10%, black 20%, blue 70%, if you can get yourself to a position where your to-do list follows those ratios, I think you'll be the most efficient person when it comes to how you spend your time. Does that answer the question?
It answers the question brilliantly, Matt. Yeah, that really does. And that's a really insightful and thoughtful answer, actually, because I can picture quite quickly how anyone starting out in business today, or maybe they're sort of 12 months into growing their business, can step back for a moment, think about where they're spending their time and how they're spending their time. Something you mentioned a moment ago there, and I really appreciate those tips and insights, because I'm hoping that they'll help our listener shortcut some of their understanding about sales and selling here by perhaps avoiding some of these mistakes and flags that you're waving there, Matt. But something you mentioned there I thought was really important. You were talking about closing the sale there. And it sounds to me, I'm just sort of reading between the lines a little bit here, but through your experience, you've seen a lot of people experience a lot of drop-off at that point where maybe they've had someone really interested right through the sales process. And let's talk about that process, an overview of that process, perhaps. And maybe let's talk a little bit more about the closing element of that. I'm curious, Matt, your thoughts on that in terms of closing.
Yeah, the fascinating topic of closing. I'm in the sales training space. Most people that reach out to me for the first time for a conversation, let's say for argument's sake, they're a sales director with a small team of, let's say, 10 salespeople. The question that always comes to mind is, you know, what's going well? So find out what's happening that's going on. So what about things you'd like to try and improve? What are the one or two things that you think you could be better at? And it's always the same. We want to be better at handling objections, and we want to be better at closing. And the interesting thing about both is they are both such an easy thing to do, yet most people seem to put them on a pedestal as being the hardest things to do. Let's just break them down if we can. So contrary to popular belief, the close doesn't happen at the end, it happens at the beginning, okay? So we close people at the start of a conversation, not at the end. If we put all the pressure on trying to close somebody at the end, don't be surprised if you either run out of time or they just don't like your clunkiness. So don't forget as well, before that, every single deal is a lost deal at the moment, because until they say yes, it's always a no.
Okay,
so we just have to have that in mind as well. Back to that point about motivation and how we build confidence is just going with your eyes open. It's, at the moment, it's seeing it. No. We close at the start rather than close at the end. We close at the start because what we're trying to do really is, I teach a sales process, Rob, that's got six steps. Everyone's pretty comfortable with step one. It's building rapport. There are things that you probably can do that help build rapport. There's one or two things that you could probably do that don't help building rapport. But ultimately, that first few minutes is a bit like at the Wimbledon tennis when before the match starts, they're knocking balls across the net to each other. It's quite casual. It's backwards and forwards. They're not trying to do each other out of anything. And they're just trying to find their feet and feel their way in. Once we've got through that first stage, we're into what I class as stage two or step two of the process, which is rules. And rules really is we do need to structure expectations on both sides. Because as a salesperson, an educated salesperson, I know that there's a 60% chance this is going to go nowhere. Okay, so I'm going to do whatever I can to limit that for myself by bringing it to their attention. And so there are a number of things that we're going to have a conversation about in rules. We're going to agree the fundamental basics. How long have we got together? We're going to agree that there's got to be some kind of agenda that we're going to talk about. The interesting thing is I'll have an agenda, that the other person will have an agenda. They won't be the same, obviously. They won't be identical. But the interesting thing is, and we do a lot of this in the training work that I do with my clients, is when you write down those two agendas, there's a lot of commonality. The only difference is they're in the wrong priority order. Top of most buyers' list of things they want to get off a call with someone they meet is, what is the price? Bottom of the list of most salespeople, certainly the uneducated ones, is, let's not talk about price. And so we've right. already got this disconnect thing going on. And there's a fabulous sketch. I don't know if you ever remember it or if any of the listeners are as old as me, but there was a fabulous sketch by Morecambe and Wise where they had the orchestra guy called Andre Previn on, who was conducting the Philharmonic Orchestra. And right at the moment where they turn to Eric Morecambe, who's on the piano, to play the most important part, and he bangs out this out of tune, out of key sort of sonata. And Previn says to him, "What on earth are you doing? You're playing all the wrong notes." And Eric Morecambe says, no, I'm playing all the right notes, just not necessarily in the right order. And that tends to be what I experience when I'm out working with salespeople, is they're doing all the right things. They're just doing in the wrong places. And that's why I say to you, the close happens at the start, not at the end. And let me give you an example. So in rules, one might say to somebody, look, Rob, I have no idea how the conversation's going to go. Let me signpost to you, and I won't use the word signpost, but let me tell you a couple of ways the conversation tends to go when we have calls like this together. It's either going to go in this direction or it's going to go in this direction. If it goes in that direction, what probably happens is we'll end up having a great conversation and you and I will probably get some actions that we'll have to go away and deliver on. You're almost certainly going to want me to send you some kind of quotation or a proposal. Those are the sorts of things that happens on calls like this. So look, let's agree this. If we did go in that direction and you did decide that you wanted to get a proposal from me, all I would ask in return is that we put a date in the diary about a week after where we can jump on a call and you can tell me how that proposal landed and we can hold each other accountable for the actions that we discuss on this call. Would you be okay with that? And if you say that at the start of a call, they're almost certainly going to say yes to that. Why? Because it's a logical thing to do. What that now means is if the call does go in that direction, we have a great conversation, there is a fit, we have got some actions, they do want a proposal, it's so obvious then I'm going to say, well, look, you know, 20 minutes ago we said we'd probably want to put a date in the diary. We should probably do that now. So what does next week look like for you? And that's how you keep a sale moving forward, because there always needs to be a next step. Rather than going through the other steps, I'll just highlight the last step. So there are six steps. We've talked a little bit about one and two. Step six is return. And return is that thing where most deals tend to go to die because we don't do what I've just described. We send somebody a proposal, or we send them an email, or we leave them a voicemail, and there's no call to action. And so then we play the let's play the follow-up game. And sometimes that can go on forever. For some strange reason, there's an obvious reason why this happens, but when you send somebody a proposal, which tends to be the only piece of information that's missing in their jigsaw puzzle for them to decide what to do next, they've kind of got everything that they need from you. They don't really need you anymore. They've got your price. They've got the proposal. And so they head off into the witness protection bracket and you never see them again. And then you spend the next 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 12 weeks of your life chasing these ghosts. And so what return does, step six, is it mitigates that risk. You've got a date in the diary. You've got a clear call to action. And it's a bit like when we were kids, Rob, and we were playing football in the back garden on that hot, sunny Saturday afternoon, and the ball goes over your neighbor's fence. And you go outside, you go around the front of the door, and you knock on the doorbell. And Mrs. Smith comes to the door and says, "Oh, hello, Matt. Is your ball gone over again?" "Yeah, go and help yourself, son." And you go around there and you find your ball in the roses. You go back to your garden and you're playing football again. And then the following weekend, you've got your pal around, you're playing football, the ball goes over the fence. You go around to Mrs. Smith's and you knock on the door and they're not in. And you say, oh, what's happened there? And then your mum says, oh, they've gone on holiday for 2 weeks. And then you've got 2 weeks without your ball. And so the key thing I always say to people before you send that proposal, before you leave that voicemail, before you send that email, ask yourself the question, if I hand my ball over, when am I going to get it back? And really for me is having those sort of steps in place where you know, okay, we can be quite fluid, don't have to follow sequentially. But if I do all of those steps at some point, I limit the chances of A, wasting the other person's time, because I'm going to take them through a very logical step and a logical journey. And B, I'm not going to put myself at risk. So I'm going to try to be sensitive when I say keep control of the sale. I don't mean be controlling, but I do want to have ownership of what happens next because I don't want to waste their time or mine.
That's great, Matt. So that sounds to me like having a sales process and developing your own sales process. And that may be something that a small business owner could be doing quite early on to get clear, at least in their mind, what their sales process is going to be. And I really appreciate those tips. I think there's some brilliant guidance in there, Matt, in terms of owning the sales process, as you mentioned, but also owning it from the beginning. So I could hear how you're almost closing the deal. You're getting really clear up front about the next step, next few steps. So there aren't any surprises and everyone's clear about where they stand throughout the process.
Great point, Rob. And back to that part earlier where I said, let's swap that word sell for help. By keeping control, let's change that word as well to commitment. My passion is how do I help you commit to making the right decision for you so that your life is enriched or your business is improved or you get some kind of, let's use the expression, return on your investment? Because that's really what good selling is all about. Can I leave you in a better state than I found you? Will you make more money investing in me because I'll then make you more money in the return that you get? Because that's utopia, right? For that to happen, we have to hold each other accountable. So we've got to commit to each other. And so micro commitments, it's sometimes described as, is let's reframe that, is let's just check in. And so throughout that sale, even through a 30-minute conversation with someone, we should be asking the logical questions that normal human beings ask is, how's this going for you? A bit like you and me on this, how's the recording level going? Is my mic okay? Does that sound, is it coming through all right? How long have we got? All of those questions, if you reframe them in a sales environment, was, Rob, does that sound like the sort of thing that puts you in a better place than you find yourself in right now? How's this going for you? Is there somebody in your business you think that might not feel the same way as you? And all of those are very good questions to ask, which allows you to get the commitment back from the other person, which is, actually, Matt, there is somebody in the business I think might have a problem with this. Oh, well, okay, well, let's talk about it. Because if it can't be solved, no problem. We'll just shake each other by the hand and I'll totally understand that. But if there's something I can do to help you, help them see what you're seeing right now, which at the moment looks like you're quite interested, we should try and do that together. Does that sound like a good thing to do? And you know, it's just the way that we use our language, I think. We can't be clunky. We can't hit everything like a hammer. We just have to get rid of that imposter mask, just be ourselves, be curious and go, what's it like for you, friend? And if we can adopt that kind of tone, I think we just get on a lot better.
That's fantastic, Matt. I love that reframe there and that interchange of terminology there, which I think can be really, really helpful to think about these elements in those ways. Just coming back to your six-step process there, Matt, is that in one of your books or available online?
Yeah, you'll find that embedded in the book, which I call Converted, How to Help More People Buy What You Sell. There are actually 10 steps in there because you mentioned sales process, Rob. I've talked as a finite sales process within a sales call, but of course, a sales process we can extend at both ends, which is what do we do in a marketing world to create those leads, those bees around a honeypot? What are the steps? And then what happens in sort of customer fulfillment? How do we make sure that what we promised them actually happens? And then how do we go back in again to get a second and a third and a fourth sale, really? Because, you know, selling's hard enough to do it once. Well, if we've done it once, we've built that know, like, and trust, then in theory, we should be in a strong position to go and help them do some more with us. So you can extrapolate the sales process beyond just a sales call, obviously.
Brilliant. And that leads me very nicely into my last question before we wrap up, Matt, which is, in terms of tracking and measuring your sales performance, for want of a better description, and I'm thinking of the small business owner now, what's your guidance in terms of what you should track and what's not worth tracking?
That's a really critical point. What we don't want to be doing, Rob, in irrespective of it's small business, sole trader, startup, any business for that matter, what we don't want to be doing is winging it. We don't want to be blind. And so therefore, measurement is crucial. I remember a quote, I don't know who it was, but back in the world of Tony Robbins, I think it was, because it was one of those motivational quotes. But if you aim at nothing, you'll be sure to hit it. That's a really good mantra to leave your life behind in terms of sales. So we do need to have some kind of visibility over where we're going. We wouldn't jump in a car and drive a car without a fuel gauge, or you know, electric cars now without knowing the range, why would you run a business, or why would you run your sales team any other way than having visibility over, you know, what have we got left? What do we need to go and get? How long before I put some more fuel in the car? So we can agree for a fact that we need to have some kind of measurement process. I think there are two key ones, Rob, that I would certainly advise to any small business. So number one is, I would always go back to basics with pipeline. So if we can think about our pipeline, which is the number of leads that are sitting in various different stages of discussion. Now, the way that we work out how do we achieve that pipeline is we take our sort of year-end value. So let's just say, for example, we wanted to do £100 worth of business. I know it's a very silly number because it's quite small, but let's call it £100. And we sell our product, on average product, at £10 each. That means over the course of next year, I need to make 10 sales because 10 times 10 is 100. So I now know how many sales to make. Great news. The problem is not everybody that I go and talk to is going to want to buy from me. And so there are a number of steps that we reverse engineer away from those number of sales that allow us to know how many conversations are we going to have with an ideal customer profile. We'll refer to them as an ICP, somebody who looks like, sounds like, feels like the sort of person that fits right in our wheelhouse, who we'll do our best work with and would want our help. We've got to know how many conversations we're going to have with those. We've got to know how many of those conversations are going to turn into a proposal and a quotation, because not all of them will. We've got to know how many of those proposals are going to turn into a yes to allow us to get those 10 sales. If we go back further, we've got to know how many conversations we've got to have through networking, through our marketing, through our lead generation tech stack, whatever we might use, to allow us to have those ICP conversations, to allow us to create those proposals. And so what you can start to do, Rob, is you can reverse engineer everything back from your annual sales target number and put in some relatively conservative conversion rates to allow you to work out, okay, if I've got to make 10 sales next year, I'll have to have 100 conversations per month, right? Because 100 conversations, most of them are going to go nowhere. Some of them will. I'll turn those. Some of those wills into proper sales calls. Some of those aren't going to go anywhere. Some of them will. I'll turn those into proposals. Some of those won't close. Some of those will. I'll turn those into sales. So the first thing, piece of advice I would say to everybody is, if you do nothing else, go and do a pipeline exercise. Start your working week knowing how many conversations to have. Because in theory, and this is a bit more of an art than science rather than science and art. In theory, if you know you've got to have 10 conversations next week and you go and have 10 conversations next week, you will hit your £100 target for the year. So the first thing I'd do is pipeline exercise. And then the second thing I would do is I would build, whether you go for a CRM, I mean, you can get things like HubSpot for free these days. There's a whole bunch of other CRMs that you can go and get as an organization. If you wanted to, you can even use a static Excel spreadsheet. It doesn't matter, but just do something so that you can start to, over a period of time, after you're having these sales conversations and proposals are going out and you're seeing which ones you won and which ones you lost, you can then come up with a reasonably accurate conversion rate. And that's the second thing you need to see, is a conversion rate, because conversion rate is crucial. Because if you are not closing, let's say 50% of the proposals and the conversations that you're having into a yes, so you're losing half, if you're not doing at least 50%, then my advice to anybody is you should be. If you've done your job right, if you've got your marketing right at the start, you're attracting the right bees, you're having the right conversations, you've got some kind of sales process in place, you've mitigated the risks of it going wrong, you're not an imposter, in theory, one in two should close, okay? And if you can't get to 50%, obviously reach out to people like me and other people in the industry and say, well, where am I going wrong? And the beauty then, of course, of having a sales process in place, someone like me could point at it and go, why didn't you do that? Or what happened when you said this? So conversion rate would be the second thing that I would always ask people to take a look at. And if it's below 50%, I wouldn't say you've got a problem, but you could certainly do better.
That sounds great. And that's great guidance there. Thanks, Matt. I think that's a really sort of helpful number to keep in mind, and some really useful thoughts there too, in terms of what to track so that you can sort of see the trends, see how you're doing, keep the scorecard. And as you mentioned, you know, you've got your own fuel gauge there and set of gauges, so you can make some good decisions in terms of how to improve the opportunities that are coming to you.
Yeah. And obviously we're talking in isolation here about sales, aren't we? But, you know, outside of that, of course, there's a load of wider metrics to do with cost of sales. And it's a difficult one, Rob, when it comes to marketing. I know most marketing organizations, you know, struggle with that. How do I create a return on investment for my client? But you should be holding your marketing, outsourced marketing people accountable. Or if you're doing it yourself, you need to track the results that you're getting from your marketing. And if it's not working out for you, then the great news is, great, okay, I'll, you know, reach out to a coach. I'll get an impartial opinion. I'll try and understand why I can't see what they can see. And if they gave me the advice that I think would work, I'll try something different. So
Yeah, that's great, Matt. So there's an underlying theme there to what you're saying, which is to reach out, not to hold back reaching out. There's a wealth of support out there to help you with both the marketing and the sales side of things, which are absolutely critical to the success of any business. So to reach out and get some support. And as we've touched upon, you yourself, and there are many other useful resources out there, which we'll put some links to in the show notes. So just in closing, Matt, I'm very, very grateful for your time today. And I feel we've covered a lot in this hour, which has gone very quickly for me. Have you got any other thoughts, ideas, guidance that you would offer a small business owner? You mentioned expectations a few minutes ago. What about the expectations versus reality? What can help keep us sane as we're trying to figure this stuff out, Matt?
Expectations versus reality is an interesting topic, isn't it? Because again, I'll go back to my time when I left corporate 2014, got myself the franchise. My expectations of what was going to happen next was completely different to the reality. And back to your very useful point there about sort of go out and reach out to somebody who's walked in your shoes would be my advice. Maybe you've done something similar, Robin. Back in the day, I've wasted hours, weeks of my life trying to self-solve by reading the next best thing or watching videos on this. And whilst all that's really useful, and if to some extent for those people who are just starting out who are time rich, then why not? But the reality with that, of course, is it can be a colossal time waster, and there's no guarantee that the advice you're going to get is going to be the right advice for you. I'm sure it's great advice, but it just might not be the right advice for you. And I think that's why reaching out to somebody in the organization, a bit like the one we're associated with, can be really valuable and useful. But in terms of expectations versus reality, I've noticed, Rob, that most entrepreneurs, they tend to have a slightly different expectation setting than most of the rest of us. Very driven individuals. They know what they want. You know, they're going to go and conquer the world. Elon Musk, look out, I'm coming in your direction. And that's fabulous. Yeah. We need more people like that because, you know, we just got to keep driving this thing forward. And, you know, I'm a big fan of anybody that's an entrepreneur because, you know, just crack on and get your head down and get on with it. The danger to some extent, if there is such a thing, is when that organization starts to grow, and it needs to grow because the downside of being that fizzy is you can burn yourself out quite quickly. That did happen to me once, actually. Do too many hours, you get too intense, and there's all sorts of challenges that can come your direction. But as you grow and you take on team, you've just got to be mindful that that high setting that you've got on expectation potentially can have an impact on the people that work for you. Because guess what? They're not you. They are not going to feel the same way about your business as you do, because guess what? It's your train set. Some of those people might be introverts. Some of those people just want to turn up, be fantastic at what they do Monday to Friday business hours and have the weekend off. You might not understand that sitting at home with your laptop on your lap at 6:30 on a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday evening is just normal. It isn't for most people. And so might not be answering the question in perhaps the same way as others might answer it, but get balance, I think, is the right thing. Absolutely go and reach for the stars, have high expectations. Also be mindful that the reality of what might happen as a consequence of that can be challenged, certainly as far as team are concerned. And again, I'm going to come back to the same point we started this conversation about a few minutes ago, is reality is what somebody else will show you who's walked in your shoes, right? Here's my expectations of what I'm going to do next year. What do you think, Rob? And you're going to go, Matt, most of that I'm really comfortable with. I've got two concerns for you. I want you to think about this and I want you to think about that. Is that really reality? Could that really happen? And between the two of us, we'll come to an agreement. And you're right, I'm going to just tone those two down a little bit. So my advice really would be just be mindful of the fact that as entrepreneurs, as business owners, we probably have a slightly higher setting than others. Just be mindful how that setting and that volume knob goes across to other people.
That's fantastic advice there, Matt. I'm really grateful for that. So we've covered a lot of ground. I feel we've covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything else our listener needs to be thinking about at this stage, Matt? Anything else they could be considering?
A couple of things sort of skirted past. The two things that served me really, really well in the first 12 months of working for myself were working out who my ideal customer profile is. By that, we mean who is the right person that I would do my best work for? Because there are some people out there we're meant to serve, others not so much. So let me get really focused on who are the people that my product or service can really help. So the first thing I would say to you is spend some time, if you don't already know, and work out who that is. If you're already trading, then just go and point to somebody in your portfolio of clients who you really enjoy spending time with, that are really great at communication, that you have a good level of communication dialogue. They pay their bills on time. You're happy with the money that you earn as a consequence. They're happy with you. Maybe they've given you a case study. Go and find more of those would be my first thing. Because again, we can spend a lot of time with the wrong people. And that's difficult in the early few months and years of start. Because as we know, Rob, we'll, at the start, we'll take anything from anyone just to keep the cash flow coming in. And that's normal. Just don't make it a habit. So get clear on who your ICP is. And then the other thing that served me really well in the first 12 months was learn to pitch. Learn to pitch. Because if you know who your ideal customer profile is, what you will, there's a fundamental part of that exercise, which is what are the big three problems that they've got, and how do I solve those big three problems for that ideal customer profile? When you know that level of detail, what you can then start to do is go into rooms. And when I say rooms, it doesn't necessarily mean in person. This can be the work that you do in marketing and the information that you push out, for example, on LinkedIn or through your website copy. You can talk directly to that person. Some of that conversation that you have, some of that narrative can be very positive. And so we help people improve this and, you know, make real steps towards that. Sometimes you have to turn it in a different direction, which is we help people solve that problem or move away from that risk. And both are really relevant. And I'm no marketeer, but I do know you need a healthy dose of pleasure and pain. But if you get really good at pitching in either direction, what that's doing is two things. Number one is it's allowing you to be completely confident when you go into that room of strangers. And when someone says, so what do you do then, Matt? You can say, well, look, I tend to work with people who've got these two big challenges and this is how I fix it. And so you can be quite confident and natural when you deliver that message. But every time, of course, you say that, you hear that yourself as well. And so you're constantly reminding yourself about the challenges that you fix, the way that you improve people's lives, and the ideal customer profile that you work with. And what that does, last point, psychologically, is it triggers your internal, what is called the reticular activating system, which is that part of the brain which locks on to the things that you most think about. And the example they always used to use in psychology is you buy a new car, it's a white BMW X3. Before you bought it, you never saw them on the road. That's why you want one, because you'll be the only one driving it. The day after you're pulling out of the showroom, you see them everywhere. And the reason you see them everywhere is because they were always there. You just didn't see them before because they weren't in your RAS. Yeah. And so that combination of telling people or sharing with people what you do and who you work with and hearing it yourself means they are constantly on your radar. And that's wonderful from a sales perspective, because the more you talk about it and think about them, the more they show up.
Brilliant. Matt, that feels like a really great place to end our conversation today on. Final question, where can our listener learn more about the wonderful work you do teaching, coaching, mentoring others with their sales and selling, and find out more about Matt Sykes?
I'm always hovering around on LinkedIn. So by all means, come and connect with me on LinkedIn. The second thing I would say is obviously partner with the Business Growth Coaches Network. So if you head over to bgcn.co.uk, you'll find me on that platform as well. Or I also, my business is called Sales Cadence. So salescadence.co.uk. If someone's interested to know a little bit more about the work that I do, there's a standalone page on my website, which is called the Sales Audit. So we talked a little bit, Rob, about products for prospects. So there's a place you can go in your own time. I'm nowhere near you, but you can actually audit yourself against some of those steps of that sales process we started to unpack a little bit. You can go and spend 5 or 10 minutes there answering some questions. It'll send you back your results. So if anyone was interested to learn a little bit more, the first thing I would suggest they do in their own time is go and take that audit. So it's salescadence.co.uk and the tab on the website is called Sales Audit.
That's perfect, Matt. Thanks ever so much for that. I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes. You've been very generous with your time and the wealth of wisdom that you have to offer today. Thanks, Matt. So thanks for being on the podcast.
I've loved it, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me. And let's just hope that somebody who's listening to this is engaged enough to realize that actually selling is a good thing. Don't listen to the naysayers who think that sales is something which is manipulative or pushy or... There'll be a few people out there, but broadly speaking, if you be yourself, just normal, mitigate some of those risks, pick up some of those tips. A life in sales, as I know from my own personal experience, is quite a fulfilling place to be. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
Cheers, Rob.
Thank you for listening to this third episode of the Start, Build and Grow podcast. And thank you to my guest, Matt Sykes, for sharing his expertise and knowledge with us today. In this episode, we talked about the difference between selling and marketing and your ideal customer profile, and how to help your prospects commit to the sales process. We also talked about ways in which you can develop your selling confidence and how to avoid many of the common mistakes folks make when not following a well thought through sales process. This podcast project has been funded by the UK government through the UK Shared Prosperity Fund and Ipswich Borough Council. Start, Build and Grow is part of the BGCN Group. Discover more business growth, leadership, coaching and enterprise resources at bgcn.co.uk or email us at info@bgcn.co.uk.